I basically just think it would be interesting to look at the emergence of a criminal economy.
And also, I'm always amazed that there aren't more profiles of her out there.
This really subversive, strange thing, in rap especially.
And see what their lives are like on both sides of the border.
From One World Trade Center in Manhattan, this is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. It's the middle of August, so it's only appropriate that the show get a little steamy today.
In boarding school, I accumulated like essentially a trunk full of bodice rippers, and the only one that I saved was Savage Thunder by, I don't know if you say Joanne or Johanna Lindsay. There's essentially a sex scene that takes place on horseback.
That's Curtis Sittenfeld, whose own novels are often romantic, although the sex in them is a little more conventional. She'll talk later with The New Yorker's Josh Rothman about their shared interest in romance novels. Because today on the show, it's all about fiction. Now, I've always loved a good spy thriller, whether it's a heady John le Carré chess game or Jason Bourne defying death every 90 seconds. But right now, it's the old-school spy novels that feel surprisingly and especially current, because everything we've learned about Russia and the election of Donald Trump feels in some way like a Cold War spy novel, and not a very believable one at that. I find Jason Matthews' fiction a little bit more believable than real life. Matthews was a CIA operative for over 30 years, recruiting spies and informants in the former Soviet bloc and other places. After retiring from the agency, he started writing. Matthews' Red Sparrow trilogy is full of surveillance and heavy-breathing sex and the streets of Moscow, and I've got to admit it, I love it. It's a great diversion. The third book is on the way, and it's called, maybe with current events in mind, The Kremlin's Candidate. You know, the two novels you published, Red Sparrow and Palace of Treason, and I presume the next one, The Kremlin's Candidate, which is coming next year, that these books are all set in Moscow, and you tell me you've never been to Moscow. You've never been to Russia at all.
Absolutely not. I've never been to Russia. I've served in the East Bloc during the bad old days, and I'm familiar with the city of Havana. During my visit there, I was under surveillance 24 hours a day, but I've never been to Moscow.
I don't believe you, even as much as I admire those books, but okay.
I swear to you, I've never been to Moscow, and I can't travel there now, that's for sure.
Yeah, that's for damn sure. So I want to know why you set the book in Moscow. If that's a place you never were, you did that because that's the center of our interest as a readership, or because you'd never been there, it was easy in some odd way.
No, Moscow is the big show. Moscow is where the Cold War was fought in the alleyways, and I wanted to write spy novels about the special challenge of the Cold War of operated against the Russians. A lot of very successful thriller writers. Their default subjects are counterterrorism or a former FBI guy is being chased by crazed colleagues with the help of a bipolar girlfriend, does something amazing. And I wanted to tell a more basic story about the classic Cold War struggle of East and West.
Now, Jason, I lived in Moscow from the very beginning of 1988 until the end of the Soviet Union with my wife, who's still my wife, thankfully. And we were very young, we knew that the apartment was bugged, that we were followed, that the office was bugged, that the office staff had to be hired from an organization that was clearly had to inform each week. And I wonder what you as a spy think that they're learning from bugging journalists. What are they counting on there?
Well, you know the Russians' state of mind. They're xenophobic. They don't want to be ignored. They want to be respected. They have a fascination for outside things. They're caught eternally between Catherine the Great and Ivan the Terrible. So they think that that Remnick is a CIA officer under journalist cover, even though we do not use journalists undercover at all. We are constrained from that.
Not in years. We used to.
Yeah, we found that journalists really didn't have the skills that we were looking for.
Bad spies, yeah.
No, but so the Russians thought for you and your wife, because they had sort of a historical perspective of wives making meetings, pushing the baby buggy while the husband led them away on surveillance runs. They thought that to listen to you, you would A, make a slip, or B, they would get a baseline of what's normal in your house at night. And if the recordings or the audio or maybe even the video revealed that you guys are acting strange, it could be a signal of imminent operational activity, and they would put on extra surveillance.
So give me an instance of you were recruiting an agent. Obviously, you can't tell us the year and place, but tell me the story about a complicated recruitment of an agent in your experience.
Well, we go through a lot of study about what motivates people, and we have an acronym, which is MICE, MICE. And it stands, those are the four basic motivators of human nature. And it stands for money, ideology, conscience, and ego. So we all have those motivators. So during, in the recruitment cycle, during the developmental phase, you're basically getting to know the person as your best friend, as your brother or sister. And you're analyzing and assessing not only motivations, but vulnerabilities, human wants and desires. So for instance, I had a case that was going along fairly well, but it was based on a true friendship between me and the agent being the foreigner. My time in this assignment was coming to a close, so I was telling him, we're going to have to do what we call a turnover. You're going to meet a new friend. And he said, absolutely not. I've been doing this for you and for you only. And I said, okay. And he was adamant. The next week, I told him, I owe you an apology. I sent in some of the comments that we had discussed the last week, and it went straight to the president's desk. It was all nonsense. Of course, it hadn't. But he puffed up, M-I-C-E-E, ego, and he said, the president read the stuff I sent in? I said, that's right, and we're all very sorry that you can't continue doing this. 6 weeks later, he'd made the turnover meeting with a successor case officer, and the case continued.
Now, so far as I know, there's no S in MICE, no S for sex. And yet you have in your novels a heroine who is sent off to train in what's called Sparrow School, which is essentially a place where you learn the erotic arts in the service of spying for Russian intelligence. Is sex not a motivator? Is sex not a tool?
Sex is a motivator. It generally falls under the category of ego. Our colleagues, our brothers and sisters in military intelligence, actually do put an S at the end of MICE because they are unaware that MICE is that's the plural of the word. But the Western services do not use sex as a motivator like the Russians used to. There's no sexpionage, there's no blackmail, there's no coercion, there's no...
You say used to, you know, that's no longer part of FSB's arsenal?
Well, they no longer have a Sparrow School. I think if, for instance, a foreign diplomat engaged a young lady in a hotel bar in Moscow and got in trouble, she's probably an independent contractor. And the FSB would use what they had on the guy, but they don't do it as a rule.
Now, our intelligence community has said that the Russians, directed by the Russian leadership, interfered in the election. A lot of people, though, say, look, we need more proof of this, real proof. With the background that you have, do you think that we should be skeptical of those intelligence agencies or not?
Well, the 17 intelligence agencies of the intelligence community include Department of Homeland Security and the Coast Guard and things. Many of them do not know sort of the nuances of what the Russians call active measures. The Russians have been doing active measures, which is a political influence campaigns, since the 1920s, when they were trying to disrupt the white Russians hiding in Paris after the revolution. They do it all the time. They do it in Europe. They do it naturally. So did they affect the election? I think they may have changed some people's mind, but did they change the number of votes? Did they change the Electoral College? I don't think so, no.
So what you're saying is interference in elections is a given in a certain way, but you're not all that concerned about it.
No, I'm not. I'm not concerned about it because it's what the Russians do, and it's what we should know they do, and we should guard against it. I mean, the fact that the DNC didn't have any protections on their mainframe is just astounding.
So the former CIA director, John Brennan, was testifying in front of the House Intelligence Committee in May, and obviously had to do with the Trump situation. And he said, look, frequently, people who go along a treasonous path do not know they are on a treasonous path until it's too late. Now, we're not necessarily talking about treason, but when Donald Trump Jr. it has email exchanges in which he shows an eagerness to meet with Russians who are offering what could be dirty information from Russian sources, Russian government sources, that's something else again, isn't it?
Well, I think the Russians were testing them. That meeting clearly to me was an assessment meeting. Did Jared look up from his phone? Did anyone flirt with the lawyer? Did anyone ask for any special favors? And you can be sure that of the Russians in that room, they could have been co-optees, they could have been retired. But you can bet your bottom dollar they talked to Uncle Sasha the next day.
Uncle Sasha being an intelligence...
Active duty FSB or SVR, mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yep. So it was an assessment meeting. And the Trumps, who are not particularly used to this kind of world, went in sniffing to try to find some dirt on Hillary. Immoral? I don't know.
I wonder what you make of the whole business of Christopher Steele, the British intelligence officer, very experienced and now working in the private sector. He compiled what's known as the Steele dossier that had not only the salacious sexual stuff, which got a lot of play, but also a lot of other information about Trump and Trump's behavior in Russia. When you read that dossier, did it feel authentic, a fraud? What was it?
I know you speak Russian. Disinformatsiya.
Disinformation.
Disinformation.
Yeah.
I think it was so salacious and so outrageous. I mean, that's what the Russians do the best. It's their bread and butter.
Meaning they're better at it than we are?
Absolutely.
Why is that?
They're cunning. They are masters at the chess game, at the moves. And disinformation. And disinformation can come in, many different forms, some of which contradict the other ones, thus giving more credence to the final line they want to push. They're absolutely masterful.
Now, the nerviest thing you do in your novels is that Vladimir Putin himself becomes a character. And
yes.
that's rarely done in spy novels. I wonder why you decided to do that, and was it just to have a kick or just do something that no one else had done before?
Well, a little bit of both. I wake up every morning and I thank Vladimir for being Vladimir. I mean, he's a terrific character in and of himself, and I asked, when my first novel, I asked my editor, could I be sued for slander if I included President Putin in my novels? And my editor said, pray for a lawsuit.
Jason Matthews, thank you very much.
Thank you, David.
Jason Matthews. The first two books in his Red Sparrow trilogy are available now. There'll be a movie of the first novel with Jennifer Lawrence coming soon. And the third book, The Kremlin's Candidate, is due this winter. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. Welcome back to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I said earlier that the show today was going to be all about fiction, and I have to say I lied a little bit, just a little, because this is a true story.
I have said that I heard screams. I have since read that screaming with hysteria is a common reaction, even to expected total eclipses.
Annie Dillard is one of our great nature writers, and years ago, she wrote a brilliant essay about witnessing a total eclipse of the sun. She read some of it for us when I spoke with her last year, and with Monday's eclipse of the century, it's probably worth hearing again.
People on all the hillsides, including, I think, myself, screamed when the black body of the moon detached from the sky and rolled over the sun. But something else was happening at that same instant. And it was this, I believe, that made us scream. The second before the sun went out, we saw a wall of dark shadow come speeding at us. We no sooner saw it than it was upon us like thunder. It roared up the valley. It slammed our hill and knocked us out. It was the monstrous, swift shadow cone of the moon. I have since read that this wave of shadow moves 1,800 miles an hour. Language can give no sense of this sort of speed. Seeing it and knowing it was coming straight for you was like feeling a slug of anesthetic shoot up your arm. If you think very fast, you may have time to think, soon it will hit my brain. You can feel the appalling, inhuman speed of your own blood. We saw the wall of shadow coming and screamed as it hit. It was as though an enormous, loping god in the sky had reached down and slapped the earth's face.
Annie Dillard read from her essay, Total Eclipse, when I spoke with her last year. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. In 1967, Elaine Konigsberg, a stay-at-home mom living in the New York suburbs, started writing children's books under the name E.L. Konigsberg, and she won a Newbery Medal, the highest honor in children's literature, right out of the gate. The book is called, and it's a rather baroque title, From the Mixed-Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler. It's about two siblings who run away from home, but unlike some of the other literary runaways, Claudia and Jamie don't raft the Mississippi or take up residence in a boxcar. They have a more distinguished hideaway in mind.
It's the Metropolitan Museum of Art. It's a castle, Jamie, my Camelot. I've been there and it's a perfect place for us to stay. You'll be Sir James, a knight of the round table.
Then you gotta be Sir Claude.
I'm Lady Guinevere, King Leodogran's ravishingly beautiful daughter. Shall we ascend, Sir James?
Why not?
Konigsberg's book has been a classic ever since. It inspired two films, More than that, it inspired 5 decades of children to imagine the Metropolitan Museum not as a place your parents might drag you on a rainy day, but somewhere you might go all on your own to get lost in and have adventures. One of those children is, or was, Gia Tolentino, now a contributor to The New Yorker. And a couple of weeks ago, she did just that.
Ladies and gentlemen, the galleries are now closed for the evening. Please proceed to the exit.
I'm Gia Tolentino, and recently I snuck into the Met after hours on a rainy Wednesday and got to run around while no one was there, which has been a dream of mine ever since I was little and read E.L. Konigsberg's From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler. I think it's impossible to read the book and not want to be in the Met and have it to yourself the way that they do. It's this achievable adventure. You read the book and you think, I could do this tomorrow. And I did.
They wandered back to the rooms of fine French and English furniture. It was here Claudia knew for sure that she had chosen the most elegant place in the world to hide. She wanted to sit on the lounge chair that had been made for Marie Antoinette, or at least sit at her writing table. But signs everywhere said not to step on the platform, and some of the chairs had silken ropes strung across the arms to keep you from even trying to sit down. She would have to wait until after lights out to be Marie Antoinette.
You know, in the book, there's one time where they're almost, the guards are operating on something of an irregular schedule, and Jamie almost gets caught, and she talks about miles and miles of time. That's such a beautiful description of walking through the museum, where you're literally walking through eras.
At last, she found a bed that she considered perfectly wonderful, and she told Jamie that they would spend the night there.
Wow, I'm so sleepy all of a sudden. We just walked into a dark gallery in the European Sculpture and Decorative Arts wing, and we are approaching this big, ornate canopy bed that's the closest thing that's currently on display to the bed where Claudia sleeps in the book, and it's towering, and it looks like a birthday cake, and there are these like satiny light blue curtains, and the bed is very high up, like a kid would have to hoist herself up and really crawl in. The thing is, you know, the real thing to do would be to sleep on the floor behind the bed, because then really nobody could see you. I think I'm a little more practical than Claudia. I wasn't into luxury as a kid, but I was into secrets, and so I think I would have tried to curl up on that chair behind this little ornate screen. When kids read this book, there's a certain type of feeling that the book gives you, which is that you are able to do so much more if left to your own devices than you are in your everyday life.
Lady Claudia and Sir James quietly walked to the entrance of the restaurant. They easily climbed under the velvet rope that meant that the restaurant was closed to the public. Of course, they were not the public. They shed their clothes and waded into the fountain. Claudia had taken powdered soap from the restroom. She had ground it out into a paper towel that morning. Even though it was freezing cold, she enjoyed her bath.
So we are where the fountain restaurant used to be, which is the setting of what is arguably the most memorable scene, which is where there is a big fountain in the middle of the restaurant. They realize they can slip through the ropes and take baths in it, and also pick up all of the coins that are on the floor, and then they can afford more lavish meals at the automat. It's nice because there's a little fountain, even though there's no more giant fountain with the dancing bronze sprites in it anymore. You can still hear it. When you're a kid, you feel like the person you are on the inside does not transpose to the outside, and you feel essentially unknowable, and like no one sees you clearly because you can't communicate the inside of your head clearly at all. And that's why Claudia runs away. And the museum is this physical space that corresponds to this idea that she has of herself, where there are hidden corners everywhere, and there are secrets and there are surprises. But you know, honestly, but as a kid, I think what I liked about it was just that she ran away and she didn't miss her parents. And she had a great time and she never got scared. So we just left Claudia's bedroom, walked through medieval art, and now we're in this sort of Italian Renaissance room, staring at a Cupid sculpture that Michelangelo sculpted when he was 15.
A statue of an angel. Her arms were folded, and she was looking holy. As Claudia passed by, she thought that that angel was the most beautiful, most graceful little statue she had ever seen.
So Claudia gets really obsessed with this angel statue that's on special display at the museum. She's sort of in contact with something that inspires her for the first time in her life. And her reaction to it is she wants to hug it. She wants to find out everything about it. She wants to devote her life to finding out where it came from and what it means. And, you know, I think maybe that's an early draw for a lot of kids with this book. It's an encounter with adult concern and how the many confusing ways that manifests. Yeah, she just desperately wants to hug it. Yeah. I've never wanted to hug a statue. it's so touching, right?
When you hug someone, you learn something else about them, an important something else. Jamie shrugged his shoulders. Both looked at Angel a long time.
I have a younger brother who is 5 years younger than me. I think Jamie is just 2 years younger than Claudia. But our relationship was pretty similar, I think, to theirs. I was more pedantic and also more adventurous. And he was more practical and very calm and occasionally very surprising the way Jamie is.
Jamie looked over at Claudia. He shouldn't have. Claudia looked as satisfied as the bronze statue of the Egyptian cat she was standing near. The only real difference between them was that the cat wore tiny golden earrings and looked a trifle less smug.
Oh, is this the cat? Oh, the cat does look very smug. The first time I came here, I was in 9th grade, and I had driven to Toronto with my family from Texas and then driven back down, and we had gone through New York City on the way back down. And I was in that Claudia state of mind where I was like, everybody, leave me alone and respect the adult I am. And I went to the Met with my little brother, and actually, as it does for the kids in the book, it kind of calmed us down. We were awed and walking around in the big crowds and staring at things, and we're too overstimulated to be fussy. I think me and my brother could do well hiding in the Met. Of all the museums in New York City, I would definitely pick the Met to hide out in, that's for sure. Walking around the Met today, there's so much from the book that is no longer physically present, but something about it still feels powerfully and fundamentally the same. I have never enjoyed getting messages after writing a piece more than after this piece. I got this one incredible email from a woman named Claudia. She wrote to me and said, in 1967, I was 11 years old and in the 6th grade. A smart teacher in the library one day handed me the book and said, Claudia, you need to read this. And she loved it. She became obsessed with it. And she wrote to me, I'm reading from it now. This past March, my husband and I made our first trip to New York City. I have to tell you, I was so happy to be there and send my private thanks to E.L. Konigsberg and my prayers by a stained glass window. I just thought it was amazing that it was just as magical for her, and it had retained that magic for a solid 50 years. It had changed her life.
Gia Tolentino, and From the Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler by E.L. Konigsberg. We heard Jill Clayburgh reading the audiobook. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. And in a minute, we're going to convince you to feel a little less guilty about a guilty pleasure that maybe you already have. We're talking about romance novels. That's just ahead. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Josh Rothman is a man of wide interests. He's written for The New Yorker about philosophy, about fashion, about science. But among those many interests, one really stands out. Josh says he's never met another man who's into romance novels or who will admit reading them. He recently talked with Curtis Sittenfeld, who has 5 novels under her belt, books that involve romance, but they're not exactly romance novels either. Last year, Sittenfeld published Eligible, a modern retelling of what we might consider the prototype, the great-grandmother of all novels about romance, Jane Austen's Pride and Prejudice. Curtis Sittenfeld asked the first question.
Can I ask you what your definition of like a romantic novel is?
Well, certainly there's lots of classic novels that are essentially romance based.
But I also read
like a reasonable quantity of like Nora Roberts. And
that's what I was curious. So essentially, would you say bodice rippers? Like, is that a fair or is that a derogatory term?
I don't know if that's a I've never read 50 Shades of Grey. And I don't think of Nora Roberts as a bodice ripper type writer. I think there it's still pretty romantic in the sense that, you know, it's mostly about unresolved sexual tension, so to speak, between the protagonists. And it's not quite about sex, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. I started reading these books when I was, I don't know, probably 10.
Me too.
Yeah. Like a pre-adolescent or early adolescent kind of experience. And I think I've read actually, you know, probably a zillion romantic novels over the course of my life. I mean, how did this start for you? Like, what was your introduction?
My gateway was Danielle Steele in fourth grade. I read Harlequin romances around sixth grade. And then I read the ones where it's sort of like, you know, the woman has like a blouse that's falling off her shoulders and her cleavage is showing. And the man, which I think Fabio was the model for a lot of these in the 80s or 90s. And then they're sort of like intertwined, like whatever you want to give the name to those. Mm-hmm. I amassed a pretty large, I don't know if I'd say a zillion. And I actually do not read those anymore. But I read them for a long time and they were a big part of my life.
And then was there a point where you started writing stories that were about love?
Yeah, I think that I sort of became a person who I would almost say I wrote more about like awkward hookups more than romance or like unrequited love and yearning. But so it's almost like the flip side of romance, but it's, you know, it's kind of in reaction to romance or like in the neighborhood of romance.
So in Eligible, so a few years ago, you wrote this book, Eligible, which is a sort of reimagining of Pride and Prejudice that takes place in the modern world. And in Pride and Prejudice, the original, the Austen novel, the moment, I guess you could say, where Lizzie Bennet and Darcy notice each other, what happens is Jane, Lizzie's sister, is sick, and Lizzie has no way to get from her house to the house where Jane is staying. So she runs there, basically. And and when she gets there, she's like breathing hard and maybe a little sweaty and her hair is a little messed up, and she runs into Darcy, and that's when he notices her, I guess. And in Eligible, you came up with the cleverest way to do this in the contemporary context. And I wonder maybe you could just tell that.
Yeah, yeah. So Eligible takes place in 2013 in Cincinnati, Ohio, as all the best novels do. And it's summertime. Jane has fainted at lunch and has been taken to the ER. And it's midday in summer in Cincinnati, so it's like 100 degrees. There are no cars at home. And so she thinks, okay, I'm just going to put on my running clothes and run like 5 miles to the hospital. And then my Darcy is a neurosurgeon. And so conveniently, they run into each other outside the entrance to the hospital where she's like sweating everywhere and is totally disheveled.
And as I recall in Eligible, I mean, it's pretty sexy. Like, she's in her running gear. I think she's just in like a sports bra and shorts. And she like runs her hands through her hair and a drop of her sweat flies from her hand and lands on Darcy's white coat. And they both see it happen, but nobody says anything. It's just a little moment of contact, you know, that's like a little...
Well, it's funny. I don't know if that's everyone's definition of sexy. I'm glad to hear it's yours.
So I was at dinner with my wife's family and I was telling them, oh, you know, I'm going to do this radio interview where I talk about romance novels. And everyone was shocked that this was a thing that I was into. And I discovered, you know, there were no, of course, none of the other men at the table had ever read, so they claimed, a romance novel. But they all read like detective novels or thriller novels. And it occurred to me at that moment that maybe part of the way it works is that it's about familiarity. So unlike you and me, who started reading romance novels when we were small, plenty of guys never did that. And so to them, the pleasure of a new story is relatively small. You actually have to have read a lot of them in order to get a lot of joy out of these stories. You have to be in the habit, and then something about romance comes alive. But anyway, that's my pet theory that I've been mulling over.
Well, I think I also do think that it could have to do with packaging, where I think that, like, and again, these are sweeping generalizations about gender, which are very easy to disprove. But I mean, even like the covers of my books, there's a preppy ribbon belt on one cover. On the cover of Eligible, it's a diamond ring. Mm-hmm. And so I think that that telegraphs to men, unfortunately, like, this is probably not for you. Like, I think that plenty of men have the capacity to take the same pleasure in a romantic story or to be moved by it. I don't know, you know, like Braveheart or mm-hmm. The Wire or something. I feel like my readership has been 90% at least female ever since I first started having books published. And I had my first story published in The New Yorker in August 2016. It's about two people who don't really know each other who end up, a shuttle driver and a woman on a business trip, who essentially end up having, like, spoiler alert, like a hookup in a hotel room. And the photo is sort of like the bottom two-thirds of a woman lying in a bed with her legs crossed. So it's like a pretty sexy photo, but it's not feminine. Anyway, I heard from a very disproportionate number of male readers where they were like, I loved your story in The New Yorker, Curtis. And I thought, okay, is it that it was in The New Yorker and The New Yorker is neither male nor female? Is it that the illustration was sexy, but also, you know, not overtly feminine or masculine? Is it that the story itself was kind of sexually graphic that made me have this spike in male readership? But I think above all, I think it was the fact that there's nothing about this that's saying men don't read it. Like, if anything, it's saying, like, men, give us a read. And so it was very, so it's like, I think that it, what we're talking about could really be, like, aesthetic or visual or, you know, have to do with marketing.
That's really, that's fascinating. One sort of, like, criticism one could make of romantic fiction is that it just ends, there's always a happy ending, first of all, and it always ends with the end of the courtship. What do you think about this thing about romance sort of having a circumscribed temporal dimension where it just sort of ends with the wedding? Did you resist that, or what's your feeling about that?
I didn't resist it in Eligible.
Right.
I almost feel that a romance is one of the few inherent or natural narratives in human existence. You know, being born and dying has a kind of shape, but it's too elongated or like slack or something. But romance is this thing where, like, it has the structure of a story. You don't have to impose it from the outside.
I guess on some level we're approaching the question of whether romance is real.
Is it a
script?
Yeah.
That people follow? Because I think maybe one thing that's emerging is, for you and me, romance novels are really fascinating because they're true. I mean, like, they're about the most interesting part of real life. But if you're not a romance reader, then I think your conception of a romance novel is the opposite, that it's, like, completely false.
Well, I feel like, I mean, I think anyone who's ever had a crush on someone else would have to say, yes, they are realist. I mean, you know, not all of the details, but it's like, it's not, I don't know. There is a line that I read relatively recently, and I wish I could remember where I read it. It's something like, would people fall in love if there weren't stories about love or songs about love? You know, like, have we all been sort of primed to want this thing? And there's almost like this feedback loop or something.
And another way of saying this is when I was in college, I was a creative writing major, and my teacher was Edmund White. And at one point I had handed in a bunch of stories, And they were all pretty romantic, basically. They were about couples and things. And he asked me, we were having like a one-on-one meeting, and he asked me, are your parents divorced? And I said, yeah, why? And he said, well, because I find that often my students with divorced parents write the most romantic stories.
Oh.
So, and that's always interesting to me. Like, why is it so fun to read and think about these things, even if, like, I'm married, I happily so, and have a wonderful romantic marriage and things, but I don't have a, but my appetite for reading these stories about anguished lovers that can't get together is basically undiminished. And I wonder, like, in your case, why do you think you love these stories so much?
So I guess, I mean, I think the short answer, by the way, I feel like saying I have a wonderful romantic marriage is a very unusual sentence to be uttered aloud. I feel like that should be its own podcast and it should be like 3 hours long. So I think that the romantic story kind of contains everything. Like, I think that essentially so much fiction is about people acting against their own best interest. And there's this sort of pretense that we're all, like, you know, very responsible and almost like trying to be our best selves and wearing Fitbits and like making healthy choices. And like, there's something about, you know, romance that can be so self-destructive, or like you run the risk of like humiliating yourself, or you're so vulnerable. And the fact that it's worth it to people is must mean like it's really great. Like, that you get to feel really deep feeling, you know, physical and emotional feelings. Like it's almost like you can tell how exciting it is or how gripping it is because of how much people risk for it.
Yeah. If radio listeners out there are driving down the road listening to this and they're passing Barnes & Noble and they can pull into the parking lot right now and buy a romance novel, what should they buy?
Well, okay, can I say two?
Yeah.
my heart is torn between two romance novels. No, so in boarding school I accumulated like essentially a trunk full of bodice rippers. And the only one that I saved was Savage Thunder by, I don't know if you say Joanna or Johanna Lindsay. There's essentially a sex scene that takes place on horseback. okay, so that's one. But then the other thing I would say is read an Alice Munro book, which, I mean, I'm sure plenty of people have. But there's a particular story called Tricks in the collection Runaway. It's like devastating, and I feel like it's taken me almost years to get over it. So it's sort of, I mean, I think it's very romantic and it's very upsetting. Like, it kind of like crushes your heart in the best possible way.
That's totally awesome. Well, thank you so much.
This is so fun. I feel like I almost have like heart palpitations because I'm so excited to be talking about romance.
Curtis Sittenfeld is the author most recently of Eligible. You can find her writing for The New Yorker at newyorkerradio.org. She spoke with Josh Rothman. Now we're going to wrap up today with a story. Sherman Alexie published his first piece of fiction in The New Yorker in 1999, and this summer we published the new story by Alexie called Clean, Cleaner, Cleanest. It's about a woman named Marie who works in housekeeping at a motel. We don't know where. Maybe she's in the Northwest, where Alexie has set a lot of his fiction. Marie has stayed at her job for decades, watching as other maids have come and gone. Sherman Alexie's sister has worked as a maid, and he said that he drew on some of the things she told him about the work. Here's Alexie reading an excerpt from Clean, Cleaner, Cleanest.
Housekeeping, Marie said for the fourth time. No response. So she knew there was nobody in the room. The guest was gone. He was a clean one. Almost all the garbage was in the wastebaskets. The toilet was flushed. The sink had been wiped down. The used wet towels were piled in the shower instead of tossed onto the floor. A $1 bill folded into an origami crane had been left on top of the TV. A small gratuity. There were no human or animal body fluids splashed on the floors, walls, or ceiling. None that were obvious, anyway. But the guest had left takeout food in a styrofoam container on the wooden table, a mostly eaten hamburger and fries. More than anything, Marie hated to clean up food. That's why she had never worked at a restaurant. It's why she rarely ate at restaurants. A table full of greasy dishes and half-empty water glasses and coffee cups made her nauseated. In particular, she hated the smell of old cooked onions. Dear Big Bang, she'd thought more than once, if I am going to hell, then I hope hell doesn't smell like old onions. In her Bible study group, she'd referred to Satan as old onions so much that some of her fellow parishioners had started doing the same. She'd even heard Father James say it once or twice. Old onions. She hated old onions. But she needed her job. She believed in her job. So she picked up the styrofoam container, held her breath against the smell of the onions, and tossed it into the garbage bag hanging off the side of her cart, then sprayed disinfectant into the bag to kill some of the odor. And then she cleaned the room. First, she picked up the dirty towels and shoved them into the laundry bag hanging from her cart. She draped clean towels over the thin metal rod. The towels had been washed, yes, but they were so old and threadbare that they'd forgotten how to be towels. Those towels had dementia. And that thin metal rod had been pulled out of the wall so often by clumsy guests that it barely supported the weight of the towels. But no matter. She still draped the towels with an eye-pleasing symmetry. Then she sprayed minty soap into the sink and the shower, did a quick wipe with her hand towel, and ran hot water to wash the soap down the drain. She sprayed the toilet bowl, flushed, and repeated the process. She didn't have to scrub any obvious stains because of the departed guest's good manners. She knew she'd only clean the surface of things. But the soap's strong, minty smell would make it seem as if she'd cleaned more thoroughly. The illusion of clean. She'd once used that phrase when she'd been talking to Father James about her job, and he'd said that the phrase accurately described humans as well. After she was done with the bathroom, she quickly dusted the small chest of drawers, TV, two nightstands, two lamps and chairs and table, plus the chandelier hanging over the table. That chandelier was only a paper-covered light bulb hanging on an electrical cord. But saying chandelier was almost like saying feces and urine. Then she dragged in the vacuum and quickly ran it over the carpet. It took her only 15 minutes to clean that room. That was good. Because a mother and father with four kids had checked out of room 144. The youngest kid, a toddler in a polo shirt, had taken off his pants and underwear, had gone full Porky Pig, then squatted and pushed out a public feces on the sidewalk in front of the soda machine. So Marie was deathly afraid of what that family might have done in the privacy of their room. She dreaded the marathon of cleaning that likely awaited her. In the beginning, there was Marie, Agnes, Rosa, and the other Rosa. Agnes was a drunk. She got fired for stealing from the guests. Rosa number one married her high school sweetheart and moved away. Rosa number two was undocumented and quit after she heard rumors about an immigration sweep of local businesses. The sweep didn't happen. Not that time. Then there was Olga, who'd come from Russia to marry an American. He'd claimed to be a millionaire, but it turned out he'd only had enough money to pay for Olga's visa and her plane tickets. She'd married him anyway because she believed that American lies were a little better than Russian lies. But she had to take a job, any job, to help with expenses. She got pregnant. They couldn't afford to pay rent and take care of a baby, so they moved to Oregon to live with his parents. Then there was Evie, who worked hard, was Marie's friend for many years, and vanished over the horizon. There was a black woman and a white woman, their names lost to time, who started on the same day and both quit immediately after walking into a room and finding a dead bull snake sliced into thick pieces and arranged in weird patterns on the carpet. There'd been 5 animal sacrifices in the motel over the years. 7 people had died at the motel. 4 from heart attacks, 2 from overdoses, and 1 when a woman drunkenly fell over the second floor railing and landed headfirst on somebody else's minivan. Marie had been slapped, punched, kicked, and bitten by former maids. Her purse had been stolen 3 times and her car stolen once. One of the crazier maids had robbed Nassim at gunpoint. She went to prison for 3 years. One of the saddest maids had been assaulted and strangled by a serial killer. He was caught after 30 years of killing poor women and led police to undiscovered bodies so they wouldn't lethally inject him. There were drug addicts and alcoholics, and women who doused their cleaning rags with disinfectant and huffed those poisonous and intoxicating fumes into their lungs. There were illegal and legal immigrants, though Marie didn't care about their status. Every refugee is a precious child, she thought. There were maids of every race, of every color, of every religion. At least 12 women, Muslims, had worn headscarves while they worked. Marie suspected that one maid, an Italian woman who had to be taught how to use a vacuum, was in the Federal Witness Protection Program. There were women who cried often, but would never explain their tears. There were women who never stopped talking about their aches and pains. Over the decades, Marie had worked with 200 or 300 women. She'd liked half of them, had hated at least 50 of them, and had truly loved maybe 12. And then there was Evie, the most beloved, who had transubstantiated into a postcard from Reno. How does a friend, maybe your best friend, leave you like that? Father James, Marie had once confessed, God is mysterious, sure, but sometimes I feel like people are even more mysterious. One slow day, as she filled in for the new owner at the front desk, Marie used the motel computer to search for Evie. She typed in Evie's full name in Reno, Nevada, and found nothing. She added the words missing and obituary and death and found nothing. Then she typed in Evie's name and housekeeper and Arizona. And there she was, smiling in an employee photo. She worked at a retirement home in Flagstaff. It had been quite a few years, but Evie still looked exactly like Evie. You're alive, Marie said to Evie's photo. Below Evie's photo was an email address and a phone number. I could call you right now, Marie said to the photo. Marie thought about distance and time. She remembered reading once that Cleopatra had lived closer in time to the building of the first Pizza Hut than to the building of the Great Pyramids of Giza. Everything is temporary, Marie thought. Then she wiped tears from her eyes, closed the browser window containing Evie's photo, and turned to greet the new guests who'd walked into the motel office.
Sherman Alexie reading from his story, Clean, Cleaner, Cleanest. That was an excerpt, but you can hear him read the whole story on our Writer's Voice podcast. We share a story from one of today's best fiction writers just about every week. And that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed the show, and I hope you've got time to read a decent book before the summer is finally over. I'm David Remnick. See you next week.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Meryl Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced with help from Deborah Treisman, Sarah Sandbeck, and Jessica Henderson. Audio from The Mixed Up Files of Mrs. Basil E. Frankweiler was read by Jill Clayburgh and is used with the permission of Simon & Schuster Audio. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.